Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey there, listeners. For this bonus episode, we wanted to reach out to an expert, someone who knows a thing or two about what adoptees experience when they reach out to their birth family, or what happens when someone finds out they're adopted later in life, like Steve Patterson did. Our producer, Kate Mishkin, talked with Dr. Amanda Baden, a licensed psychologist in New York City who's worked with adoptees, adoptive families, and has adopted herself. We were lucky to sit down with her.
This is Chapter 12, Dr. Amanda Baden on Adoption. Just to start out, would you mind telling us who you are and what kind of work you do?
My name's Amanda Baden. I'm a licensed psychologist in New York City, and I'm also a professor at Montclair State University, where I also serve as the doctoral program director. At Montclair State, we train future counselors, and in the doctoral program, we train counselor educators, those who are going to be professors training future counselors. It's very meta. And then in my practice, I have a clinical practice in New York where I work with primarily adult adoptees and adoptive families.
I'm wondering if you're open to telling me a little bit about how your own experience has informed your practice.
I think, you know, having grown up as a transracial international adoptee myself, of course, I understand a lot of the struggles. I know what they look like at various points. I've been working with adoptees for over 25 years. I have a lot of stories, a lot of histories that people have shared, that some of which overlap with mine and some which diverge completely. I try to make sure that I have very good sense of what's my history and what's theirs, not to confuse them. Mm-hmm. But I definitely can see that there's a lot of shared experiences, a shared history of how adoptees have an internal messaging system that they might use to themselves about what it means to be adopted. For kids and adolescents, can be hard to articulate. So some of what I do is really helping them find words to explain their experience and to normalize it, to recognize that they weren't the only ones who had that experience. And therefore, it can be very empowering to recognize, like, there's a real community out there that can share some of this.
I was wondering if just something we could start out with is some reasons adoptees seek out therapy in general.
Oh, sure. I think everyone is always looking to understand themselves a little bit better, looking for support when things might get a little challenging or tough. The adults that I see primarily have come for various reasons. Sometimes it's the traditional reasons we understand as, you know, different kinds of mood disorders like depression or anxiety. But a lot of it's about identity, understanding themselves as people of color, understanding themselves as adopted people. You know, many of them have been in therapy with other clinicians who don't have adoption backgrounds. And so in many of those cases, they might say, that person was supportive and kind, but maybe didn't quite understand the nuances of adoption, or they felt they had to teach them so much that it wasn't as helpful as they wanted it to be. And more recently, sometimes it's also about connections with, you know, relationship issues, romantic kinds of relationships, friendships, and relationships with adoptive family members and birth family searches. Those are all different reasons that people might seek therapy.
And so I just want to clarify, for the most part, you're talking to folks who have been adopted. You're not necessarily talking to the adoptive families.
I do work with some adoptive families. So whenever I'm working with adult adoptees, at times we'll find it might be very useful for them to have a session where they bring in their parents. We're working on them developing agency to be able to express what they want, and me to serve in the role of helping improve communication, help the adopted person advocate for themselves, help interpret some of the things that the parents may struggle to understand because they didn't live it in the same way.
What's a big misconception about adoption?
I think the most common misconception is that people think they understand what adoption is because they've heard stories and seen movies. Almost all Disney movies have an adoption theme of some sort. So these arcs tell these stories, I think, that can problematize adoption and also make it seem so rainbows and flowers and stars, like it's so wonderful all the time. And the fact is, adoption's complex and the issues are complex. So a lot of times I think people think if a child's been adopted that they're lucky, that they should be grateful, that the adoptive parents have done a wonderful thing, that they're do-gooders, and look what a wonderful life they've been given. Those kinds of things, I think, come into play a lot because it calls into question motives for adopting. It calls into question things like how an adoptee is supposed to process and think about their experience. That can make it hard because if they have this message that they should never complain and never be unhappy and never grieve anything that's related to their adoption, then that is going to become a big barrier in the relationship they have with their families and in their own processing and navigating of the feelings that come with adoption.
I want to travel back in time a little bit to the 1970s. That's kind of where the story that we're focused on takes place. In our story, this man didn't know that he was adopted until very late in life. He stumbled upon a manila envelope with the name he was assigned at birth, but really didn't ask any further questions. And finally, when his adoptive father died in 2019, he started kind of unpacking. So I was wondering, you know, back in the 70s, how common was that for adopted children to not be told that they were adopted and to have kept it a secret?
I wish I could tell you explicitly because, again, we don't have numbers on these kinds of things. We would not be able to estimate who's telling and who's not telling. I can say, though, that it still happens.
And why do you think that happens?
I think that there's a lot of answers to that. And they're somewhat individual to the parent to some degree. But I think the standard answers people give are that they want the adopted person to understand it fully. They don't know when a good time is to tell them. They think it will upset them and make them feel less part of the family.
Yeah.
These are all kind of common answers. But I also think that there's a lot of fear involved, a fear that the child may not feel part of the family. They may have questions. They may want to reach out and find birth family. There's an attempt to, if you pretend that we're all biologically related, then we'll all pretend and everything will be the same. Mm-hmm. I think that some folks might frame it as having protected the child when we know that's not always the sole motivator or necessarily an accurate explanation. I've actually worked with a person once who had suspected for many years that they were adopted and had been looking into this for years, and there had been denials and denials and denials from the adoptive parents. And the person finally confronted the parent and said, look, I'm about to do this DNA test. It's going to come out. So here's your chance to tell me. And this person was in their 50s at the time. The adoptive parents still refused. And of course, the DNA test proved it. And they finally had to have the conversation, ultimately. I don't know if they actually had a logical stream of thought around how this might play out or not, but they had been locked into this narrative for over 50 years.
I can imagine it's hard to break that after 50 years of telling the same story. Based on your experience and your expertise, when is a good time to tell a kid?
That's a great question. And I have a lot of colleagues who do adoption research as well. And one of them, who's quite well known in the field, David Brudzinski, had sent two independent researchers to me to say, hey, maybe Amanda will do this study with you, because they were both what they called late discovery adoptees, LDAs. And so they came to me with this idea and I was intrigued. So what we did was we did a survey to look at the impact of when you found out you were adopted. And the results were very compelling. What we basically found out was that if an adopted person has a memory of finding out they were adopted, then that's already a little late for them. They've already experienced some distress. So we looked at whether distress, satisfaction with life, and coping mechanisms, how they all impacted this. But if you account for the coping mechanisms that people have, adults have more coping mechanisms, that the impact of finding out that you're adopted after the age of 3 gradually increases. The older you get, the more distress.
Mm-hmm.
So what it meant to me was that memory really sits in people's minds. In my role as a faculty member, I teach a course on multicultural counseling. And when I do bring in adoption into the course, I do a little quiz for them. And I ask them, at what age do they think a child should be told they're adopted? What's fascinated me about it is that there was this range. There's always a few students who say immediately at birth, as soon as you can, but there's far more who say 5, 8, 15, 18, or never, which really surprised me. And then my explanation, my response then would be, so I don't think a child needs to understand all of the complexity of adoption to understand that they were born in someone else's body and that there's another family out there. And if you wait until they're 3, 5, 10, how many times have you had to lie to your child? Most of the LDAs, they often talk about the awareness that they'd been betrayed and lied to. It's much harder to keep these secrets. And we know secrets have a way of coming out often.
Mm-hmm.
So we try and help families recognize that if you can't be honest with your child about their history, you're going to create wedges from the very beginning that's going to make it hard to have just an honest relationship with them.
Okay. So in general, how do late discovery adoptees differ from other adoptees?
Well, I think the difference is more in they have a late start. One of the things we struggled with when designing the study was how we wanted to define late. And our study findings showed that, yeah, 4 is already a little late. So I think that the difference will depend to some degree on when they find out, because the person that you're doing this podcast about, he's just now identifying as an adopted person and now just diving into that world and has maybe changing all the things he's had to think about who he was and where he came from. Whereas adoptees who've known forever have had a head start in that. That doesn't mean they've always gotten there or done the work or had effective progress with it, but they've had the opportunities in some cases to join adoption communities, to be with other adopted people, to start incorporating that into their identity from a very early age. And the challenge is not being able to incorporate that into your identity means it may feel like your identity has to alter drastically than from what you thought it was. And knowing that there's this other family out there who may or may not have ever wanted to reconnect or something like that can throw people into a tailspin.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
In your experience, how typical is it for an adoptee to discover that they were adopted, you know, finding paperwork or some other way, but to not raise it with their adoptive parents?
I think that there's definitely communication problems in all families. And I think that some folks are more willing to have those challenging and difficult conversations than others. Someone who has not had a practice of that and maybe more unwilling to do it. And sometimes people want to close the door on something that doesn't fit into their narrative.
Yeah. Two people in this story said that they knew and they just didn't want to rock the boat. They didn't want to hurt their adoptive parents' feelings.
That goes with the grateful narrative too. Who am I to question and challenge them? I don't want to rock the boat. Maybe I don't want to deal with it either. Or maybe I like pretending this because bringing that up is going to change a lot and it's going to force some change. And a lot of times as humans, we avoid discomfort, we avoid change. And that's where denial comes into play a lot.
So I'm wondering if that's something you would recommend, seeking out records and finding a birth family.
Great question. I never say that one answer fits for everyone. Back in the 70s and 80s, even the 90s, the prevailing perspective was that any adopted person who wanted to find their birth parents probably was dysfunctional in some way, unhappy with their families, had some issues. Now, the tables have turned completely, and the perspective is if you don't want to find your birth families, then you must be in denial or something like that. So there's a lot of pressure either way. Adoptees are often pathologized and they can't win completely. But I don't think there's a blanket yes or no. I think the individual needs to really think about what they want from that, whether they're ready for it. I highly recommend therapy counseling for someone who's considering it because I've worked with lots of adoptees who went in with this mission to do the detective work and find the birth family. And then had no idea what they wanted to do with that relationship or how to approach it.
Yeah.
And it became challenging and painful for both sides because here the birth family thinks, oh, they want to know me and want to connect, but they're withdrawing and they're withholding. And it's very confusing. The communication is challenging. So anyone who's an LDA would benefit from finding community. And if they're able to and willing to get some therapy from someone who understands this experience, it can be very beneficial to them.
So once you go on that journey and you find your birth mother and she can't answer all your questions, I wonder how that might impact your sense of self.
I think that, you know, when you do find a birth family member, you're never going to have all your questions answered. You know, even when you're born to your parents, they can't answer everything. There's some mystery that's always going to be involved. But the sense of self is sometimes how we make sense of what we're hearing. Sometimes adoptees make their interpretation of the relinquishment is about them. They think it's some deficit they have or some punishment for themselves, when in fact, most relinquishments are about the problems that the birth parents are having.
Yeah.
And these are adult problems. When you go into a reunion, it's going to be hard because there aren't black and white answers.
And I wonder if we can talk about the adoptive parents a little bit. I can imagine it might be a challenging time for an adoptive parent when their child is seeking out the birth parents and siblings they never knew they had. I'm wondering what kind of feelings this might bring up for adoptive parents.
I'm guessing they would feel frustrated that they had to reveal the truth. Maybe they never intended to, or maybe they feel some shame about it. I think a lot of adoptive parents who keep these secrets don't come and present for therapy. They may not be willing to confront what's happening. One of the reasons that they may have decided to keep this secret has been their own insecurity about their status as parents, as rightful parents, as true parents. And so I would guess that it would raise a lot of those issues again for them. I've heard many adoptive parents say they didn't want to share their child. They want to erase the idea that birth parents even exist. And in those cases, we could say with fair certainty that those adoptive parents have not worked through their own issues around deciding to adopt.
What suggestions might you have for someone who wants to find the courage to say they'd like to get to know their birth family, but doesn't necessarily want to disappoint their adoptive parents or hurt someone's feelings?
I'd say that therapy can be a good start, because sometimes with the work of a solid therapist, they can help them find the words. And sometimes the therapist can even help navigate that discussion. Whenever you come against something that feels like a barrier, what often helps is to empathize with the other perspective and then try and inform that perspective. So what I might suggest someone do is empathize with their parents' fears and their anxieties and insecurities, because they may feel that they're going to lose their child or something's going to shift and change for the worse, without recognizing that it often can shift for the better if they can stay open and engaged and loving about it. There's a lot of documentaries that exist, a lot of movies that exist that can be a great conversation starters, where then you can talk about this process and how these parents, why were those parents so engaged in this search? How were they able to make sense of that, you know? That can give that opportunity to have some of those discussions that they may struggle bringing up themselves.
In that vein, what are some things that people within the orbit of the adoptee, you know, everyone in their life, what can they do to help the adoptee and support them?
I think that it can be helpful to listen, certainly, without a ton of advice giving. I think the advice giving can often be well-meaning, but can sometimes reinforce a lot of the stereotypes about adoption. And a lot of advice giving often recreates some of the microaggressions that exist. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, one of the adoption microaggressions we named was the phantom birth parents. And that's this idea of trying to make them disappear, where the birth parents are supposed to go off and not think about this again. If everyone just does their role, then everything will be fine. And it doesn't really work that way. And there's a lot of adult adoptee communities out there that can be supportive. I would say for this person, the big challenge a lot of times is for them not to get stuck in their anger and to keep moving through it and to get the support to move through it. Because what we see is someone who's struggling with making sense of their identity or something, getting stuck in that and not making any movement then.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Is there something you wish people knew about adoption that you've gleaned from your work?
I guess I would say I wish that people would recognize that adoptees aren't all damaged, that we're not all the same, that there's just as much diversity among us as there is in any other group, and that it's not a sexy narrative to put in every movie and every book, even though it seems to be a very compelling one to put in. Every time I'm watching a show, I'm like, oh, yep, there's another one. And to the point where my family laughs because we see, you know, any show that's not at all connected to an adoption story, that narrative still makes its way in as a quick and dirty way to explain why someone would turn this way or turn that way or, you know.
Yeah, as a narrative device in some sort of way.
Mm-hmm. It really is. And I guess I wish, if they're going to use that, that they do it with real education about it and with real caution, because it does contribute to the stereotypes and the stigma.
Dr. Vann, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. This is great.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much to Dr. Amanda Baden for taking the time to share her insight. We'll have some links to her work in the episode description. Her website is dramandabaden.com. Hello, John Doe is an original production by Revelations Entertainment in association with First and Last Productions. From Revelations, our executive producers are Morgan Freeman and James Younger. From First to Last, Lindsay Moreno is the executive producer. Our producing partner is Neon Hum Media. It was written and produced by Kate Mishkin. Our editor is Catherine St. Louis. She is also Neon Hum Media's executive editor. Our executive producer is Shara Morris. Our development producer is Ian Lindsay. Our associate producer is Rufaro Faith Mazarura. Sound design and mixing by Scott Somerville. Theme and original music composed by Jesse Perlstein. Additional music came from Epidemic Sound and Blue Dot Sessions. Vendel Fulton is our fact checker. Our production manager is Samantha Allison. For My Heart Media, Dylan Fagan is our executive producer. Special thanks to Adelia Rubin at Neon Hum and Carrie Lieberman and Will Pearson at iHeartMedia. I'm Todd Matthews. You can learn more about NAMIS at namis.gov. The number for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's call center is 1-800-THE-LOST. That's 1-800-843-5678. The National Sexual Assault Hotline from the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network is 1-800-656-4673. Okay, guys, this is the end of the show. If you didn't like it, don't do anything. But if you did like it, you make sure that you rate and review the show. It helps more people to find it and hear this wonderful story. Thanks again for listening.
Dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
With the best all-inclusive vacation deals to Mexico and the Caribbean, booking your getaway with Cheap Caribbean Vacations means you have more freedom to do your deal. Whether you want to enjoy snorkeling, endless margaritas and more, or simply soak up the sun and sand in a tropical paradise, Cheap Caribbean Vacations has your deal for that. Plan and book the exact getaway you want at exactly the right price for you by using our exclusive budget beach finder, or find a featured all-inclusive package to Generations Riviera Maya Resort and do your deal at cheapcaribbean.com.